Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 26th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, including a very special guest, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ShyTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Tinley Park area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for adults and children, head over to the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World. Its address is 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, Illinois. You can email them at info@moochieworld.com or give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. So we're going to start the show off today talking Cubs baseball. They clinched the NL Central Division a few days ago and right now sit at 91-69. Two games left in the regular season, both against the Cincinnati Reds. So all in all, a successful season, right? I mean, following up a 103-win campaign along with a World Series championship is not easy by any means, but the Cubs were able to clinch the NL Central and now fortify their spot in the playoffs. So I want to take a look at the Cubs down the road here as we get to the NLDS. They're going to be facing the Washington Nationals. That is guaranteed. First game is October 6th. So for this part of the show, I want to preview that series, look at goods and bads for both teams, and in the end, predict who will move on to the NLCS. So let's get started. First, I want to look at the starting rotations of both teams. Unfortunately, the Cubs have not been able to recapture their success at the pitching position in comparison to last year. I mean, last season, Arrieta, 3.10 ERA. You had Hendricks and Lester battling for the NL Cy Young Award. Of course, they finished 2-3 respectively. But this season has not been the year of the pitcher. So John Lester this year, last season winning 19 games, ERA under 3.0. This year, however, it's been a different story. 12-8 record, which is still fine, but a 4.46 ERA, and he's only eclipsed 175 and two-thirds innings pitched. And something that really stands out about Lester is his ERA plus statistic, which is a sabermetric statistic that accounts to the player's ballpark in which he plays in. 100 is considered league average. Lester at 98, and John Lackey is at 95. The Cubs have two pitchers, both of whom lead the team in innings pitched, who cannot even perform at a league average level, which is something that is very concerning. We get to Lackey also. I just mentioned him with the ERA plus stat. 12-11 this year, 4.56 ERA. Last year, it was 3.38. So the Cubs having problems, at least at the top of their rotation. Luckily, Kyle Hendricks, although he's been hurt, has done a good job pitching to a 3.03 ERA. And Quintana, whom the Cubs got in a trade acquisition, has done awesome since coming, now at a 3.74 ERA and 7-3 with the team. So the rotation is a bit shaky near the top, but near the bottom it's more solid. And keep in mind that in the postseason, the Cubs do not necessarily need to use a five-man rotation. It'll be more of a three or four. So you can definitely use Hendricks and Quintana, and then Lester, Arrieta, and Lackey will be competing for that third and or fourth spot. So when you put all the good pitchers, the guys who have done well for the Cubs together, that's actually not that bad of a rotation heading into the playoffs. Unfortunately, though, the Nationals this year, as far as pitching goes, have just been straight up dominant. At this very moment, they have three different starting pitchers who are all vying for the NL Cy Young Award. So let's take a look. Max Scherzer, 16-6, 2.55 ERA, and 263 strikeouts in 197 innings pitched. He is their ace. He's been their ace for the past three seasons, and he was an ace back on the Detroit Tigers when he and Justin Verlander were heading their rotation. So Scherzer is definitely going to be a force to be reckoned with. He will definitely be the number one starter in Game 1 of the NLDS, and that's somebody the Cubs are going to have to try and get to, because Scherzer, what's good about him is that his longevity in games is pristine. He's able to go six or seven innings every time he goes out there, and his fastball velocity continues to stay at a high rate despite going deep into games. The guy is still hitting 96 miles per hour in the sixth or seventh inning, and that's going to be a problem for the Cubs batters. Gio Gonzalez is next. Gonzalez almost won the Cy Young Award way back in 2012. He won 21 games that year and posted an ERA under 3. This season, 15-8, 2.75 ERA, 196 and two-thirds innings, and 186 strikeouts. Gonzalez, he's a lefty, and he's more of a finesse pitcher. He doesn't throw particularly hard. His fastball averages only in the lower 90s to even upper 80s at times when he's fatigued. But the good thing about Gonzalez is that he is so good at locating. He's more of a Kyle Hendricks, if you will. Very good at locating his pitches on the inner or outer half of the plate and inducing weak contact from batters. And finally, we have former first-round draft pick Steven Strasburg, who's having another great season despite being injured for a small part of the year. He's 15-4 with a 2.52 ERA, 204 strikeouts, and 175 and a third innings pitched. And he's more like a Scherzer. He is a power pitcher, a guy who in the 6th or 7th can still be hitting in the upper 90s on the radar gun. So those three starters are all going to be threats for the Nationals, and if all those three guys perform to their potential, it's going to be very difficult for the Cubs to mount anything on the offensive side of things, and rather, if Washington continues to advance, it's going to be hard for any team to mount something on the offensive side of things. But looking at both teams' offenses, I have to give a slight advantage to the Cubs, mostly because of their depth. The Cubs on the field, at least according to some stats here on baseballreference.com, here's going to be their projected starting nine. Contreras at catcher, then you've got Rizzo, Zobrist, Russell, and Bryant across the infield. Then Schwarber, Elmora, and Hayward. But don't forget now, you've got Baez, Jay, Happ, La Stella, Avila, all guys who have performed at a high level in some undefined roles. I mean, Baez, a guy who has played shortstop, he's played second this season. Happ, he's played center, he's played second, he's even played a little bit of third base when they take Bryant out of the game. And then you've got Jay, who could play center field but can actually be inserted any spot into the outfield. You could probably see him come in as a defensive replacement for Kyle Schwarber late in games to play left. So the Cubs, as far as depth go, are looking good on the offensive side because all those guys that I mentioned, of course, good at defense, but can also hit the ball. I mean, Jay hitting over 280. Happ has over 20 home runs, same as Baez, and these are guys who aren't necessarily getting regular at-bats. For the Nationals, though, don't look over them just yet. Although the Cubs have a big advantage at the catcher spot, as Matt Wieters is hitting only 225, Ryan Zimmerman, Daniel Murphy, Trey Turner, Anthony Rendon, all guys in the midst of career seasons. And then in the outfield, you've got Bryce Harper, who has been banged up, but is on the mend right now and will be ready for the NLDS, so he's always going to be a threat. Jason Wirth, who at 38 years old, still producing, and Michael Taylor, a youngster with 18 home runs and hitting 272. And then on the bench, you've got Adam Lind, who, and this is a great story, was signed to a minimal offer. I believe it was only 1 year for $2 million. Lind last season hit only 233 with 11 home runs. This year, in only 263 at-bats, is hitting 308 with 14 homers. They also have Howie Kendrick hitting 292 off the bench. So there are a lot of good pieces on both sides, but I think that the Cubs have an advantage, again, due to their depth and due to the fact that they have a lot of good hitters who have been producing even in limited roles. And finally, I want to move on to the bullpen. Now, this one is going to be an interesting one because it's almost dead even. Maybe a slight advantage to the Nationals, but we're going to take a look. Now, the Nationals at the trade deadline, they knew their bullpen was hurting, so they made a lot of moves. They acquired Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen from the Oakland Athletics, and Doolittle has functioned as their closer. Since he's come over, he's only blown one save. He has 21 of them. They also have Matt Albers from the White Sox. This season, at 34 years old, having an amazing year, 7 wins out of the bullpen and a 1.66 ERA. They've got Joe Blanton. They've got Oliver Perez as a left-handed specialist. They've also got Brandon Kinstler, who was an all-star on the Twins this season for closing. But on the Nationals right now, they're not even using him for that. They're merely using him as another fresh arm out of the pen, and he's done a great job there. Looking at the Cubs, though, they have a good closer of their own in Wade Davis. I have to say, what a trade that was, giving up Jorge Soler, who, by the way, is hitting under 200 in limited time with the Royals, for Wade Davis, who has blown only one save the entire season. They've also got C.J. Edwards and Brian Dunsing, another smart pickup, only $2.5 million, and he's been doing great. Pedro Strop also doing well. Then you've got Mike Montgomery, who has done well in multiple roles, both as a long reliever and then as a spot starter for the Cubs. And then also you've got Justin Wilson, who the Cubs acquired at the trade deadline. He started off a bit rough, but as of late has been doing better. So now the question becomes, who will win in an NLDS a best of five matchup? Well, at this point, it's going to come down to the pitching. Can the Cubs get to Max Scherzer and Strasburg and Gonzalez? And then for the Cubs on the flip end, can guys like Arrieta possibly or Lester perform well when they are needed? Those are going to be the questions and those are going to be the storylines heading into the NLDS. However, I feel that the Cubs, due to their experience from last season, will pull it off most likely in Game 5. I think they'll win it 3-2 and move on to the NLCS. With that, we're going to head south, go to the south side, talk about the White Sox for a minute. Now, they are not in playoff contention. They've only got two games left for their season. They're ending Sunday. But a lot to look forward to in the future. Somebody I wanted to talk about real quick to start is Lucas Giolito. What a season he had. Now, last year, he made his debut with the Nationals and did quite horribly. He had an ERA of 6.75 and four games started and six appearances total. And then he came to the White Sox, right? He got traded, played in AAA for most of the year, then got called up, made seven starts, had a 2.38 ERA and 45 and a third innings pitched. So what a turnaround for Giolito, which is good for him because he is ranked as one of the top prospects in baseball. And a lot of people were predicting that after last year's performance with the Nationals, that maybe he wasn't worthy. Maybe he was just another bust. But it turns out Giolito has had a reawakening here with the White Sox, has done great in his appearances. So hopefully next year he'll make the team out of spring training and can start in the rotation and produce like he has been producing, this time over a 30-start stretch, for example. So that's someone that I just thought was doing well and deserved to get recognition for because a lot of people, like I said, had written him off in the beginning of his career. Another guy who has done well and who the White Sox may not retain, however, is Jose Abreu at age 30. 33 homers, 102 RBIs, and a .304 batting average. And there were some problems for him because last season he was not producing as well as he was back in 2014 per se. I mean, he hit .293, but his OPS was down over 100 points. This year he seems to have a bit more pop in his bat, and that explains why, statistically speaking, he has had his best season in Major League Baseball since his rookie year, where he bashed 36 homers and 107 RBIs, along with an OPS of .964. So someone else who may not be getting a lot of recognition due to the team that he's on, but he has had a really good season. And speaking of good seasons, I want to focus in on Abisael Garcia for a moment, because his story has been, well, far from ordinary. So this year, at least going into camp, there was talk that the Sox actually might DFA him and send him away and cut him because he was just not living up to the potential that he had. I mean, he was a top prospect with Detroit. When the White Sox got him way back in 2013, he was supposed to be a guy to propel the team into the future. Unfortunately, though, in 2014, 15, and 16, he never eclipsed a higher batting average than .260 and never hit more than 13 home runs. He was considered a bust, and personally, I'll admit it, I said he was a bust. I'd always talk to Sox fans and debate them about their outfield, and whenever Garcia came up in the conversation, I would always say, you know what, this guy has not lived up to his potential. He was a top prospect, and he did good things with the Tigers in the half season or so that he played with them, and since he's come to the White Sox, he has done nothing of the sort. But I have to say that I ate my words a little bit because this season he has been on fire the entire year. He is second in the AL in batting average, only behind Jose Altuve, who is in the midst of a career season. If Altuve wasn't hitting .350, we'd be talking about Garcia, actually, as a possible MVP candidate. Garcia this year, .330 batting average, 18 homers, 80 RBIs, and an OPS just under .900. That is superstar material right there, and not a lot of people are talking about it. Garcia resurrected his career. He was hitting .245 just a year ago, and barely able to even get at bats because he was doing so bad. this season, though, makes the team out of camp, and all of a sudden is hitting 330 by the end of the year. So, just a great story, again, how Garcia was on the chopping block, but used that opportunity to realize that he is a good baseball player, and he needs to work hard to get what he deserves. Good for Avi Garcia, and good for the White Sox. Look, the season didn't end the way they wanted it to, and obviously everyone can say that, but we all understand they're in the middle of a rebuild. The takeaway, however, is that these young pieces that the White Sox have are finally producing, and producing at a high level at the major league level. So if they can keep doing this as the years go on and they can acquire more pieces, the White Sox vision of becoming world champions or replicating what the Cubs did is quite prevalent, and they can definitely make it happen. So that'll wrap up our talk about the MLB. We'll move to the NBA and talk about the Chicago Bulls, and boy, I am not happy with what has been going on now with the team. So the Bulls ended up buying out Dwayne Wade, and just days later, he ended up going to the Cleveland Cavaliers to reunite with LeBron James and possibly his last season in the NBA. But I want to look at the Bulls roster for a moment because this is just kind of worrying me right now. Are the Bulls unwatchable? That's a question that I have, and right now, I believe that they are completely unwatchable. Let's look at their roster for a minute and talk about who they have right now. So Chris Dunn is projected to be their starting point guard. Dunn is a guy the Bulls got along with Zach LaVine from the Timberwolves in exchange for Jimmy Butler. Dunn last season, in his rookie year, he was a first-round pick, mind you. He averaged only 3.8 points per game. That was it. Just 3.8 points, 2.4 assists. Projected to be their starting point guard, by the way. Then you've got Zach LaVine, who is a good player, but won't be back until at least December or January as he recovers from surgery. That's another problem. Then you have to think about who they've got going at the 3, 4, and 5 positions. Because right now, Denzel Valentine is supposed to be starting at shooting guard and or small forward. But Valentine, who again, another former first-round pick, only averaged 5.1 points last year per game in 17.1 minutes. And he only shot 354, 35.4% from the field. This was a guy who led Michigan State through March Madness way back when he played there. He was a captain of the team. And now on the Bulls, he's having trouble fitting in at the NBA level. Then, you've also got Cameron Payne, and when you go back and look at this, this was probably one of the worst trades the Bulls have ever done. Trading Taj Gibson and Doug McDermott to get Anthony Morrow, who is not even on the team anymore, and Cameron Payne. Payne, another former first-round pick, last season, 14.9 minutes per game, 5.2 points, 1.8 assists. This was a guy who was left off of the NBA playoff roster. He didn't even play a game in the playoffs because the Bulls didn't want him to. He actually spent time in the D-League last season on the Windy City Bulls. Yet the Bulls gave up Doug McDermott and Taj Gibson to get him. It's hard to understand, honestly. And now you're looking at Lauri Markkanen, who is their top prospect, who's supposed to be a comparison to Kristaps Porzingis. But my question is, who do they have to support him? Because right now, it's looking like nobody. And that's only a shame for Markkanen, because he is a guy who has long-term potential. He's a 7-footer. He can shoot threes. And he can convert around the rim. He's a rebounder. He is everything that embodies today's modern center or power forward player. Guys who can shoot the three, who can rebound, who can score inside. And Markkanen will be on a team that will have nobody else besides himself. Anyways, the Bulls are projected to actually finish with the worst record in the NBA. They're supposed to lose anywhere from 53 to 57 games, depending on which projection website you decide to look at. So, again, I go back to my question. Are the Bulls unwatchable? I'd like to see, if people are listening, please comment on this or send me an email at info@sportstalkchicago.com. Tell me what you think, because I think, personally, the Bulls are just officially unwatchable. I'm not saying that Dwayne Wade was a good player with the team. I mean, he did okay, right, at 18 points per game, played in 60 of them. But at least he was a name. We knew the Bulls were going to be rebuilding, but at least he was a name, a guy that they could throw out there, a prime-time player, at the end of his career who was still going to produce, still score, what, at least 18 points per game with 4 assists. And now that he's gone, there is nobody on this team worth watching except for an unproven first-round draft pick. And although the team is unwatchable now, hopefully this whole transition of what's going on here could help them at least get a number one pick next year so they could possibly draft, I don't know, Michael Porter Jr. or maybe even Zion Williamson. So I mean, there are methods down the road, but as far as right now, this season goes, I have to warn you, Chicago, it's going to be an ugly one for the Chicago Bulls. And with that, we're going to move on and talk about the Chicago Bears, and boy, am I ready to talk about Mike Glennon and Mitchell Trubisky, and also that hit that happened with Danny Trevathan. Should he be suspended for it? That's coming up in a minute. But first, let's talk about the Glennon and Trubisky situation. So, Mike Glennon this year has received a lot of criticism, right? I mean, he leads the league in fumbles with 5. He has 5 interceptions and 4 touchdowns. So, yes, there are a lot of problems with Mike Glennon right now. But the question is, should the Bears sit him in lieu of this coming weekend and throw in Mitchell Trubisky right away? And my answer to that is a firm no. And here's why. Think about Glennon for a moment. Think about what kind of situation he's in right now. The Bears have no intention of winning. Let's be honest about it. Their best wide receiver right now is Marcus Wheaton, and that's a guy who has still yet to garner a catch this season, I believe, which is quite shocking in its own right. But let's go back a moment. Let's say it's Kendall Wright, for example. Let's say he is the number one wide receiver for the Chicago Bears this year. And yeah, hey, you know what? He had a great game against the Packers on Thursday night. He had a touchdown catch. He had 59 yards. But this season as a whole, he has 14 catches for 154 yards, and the Bears are going in now to week 5. In Wright's case, he's averaging only 3.5 catches per game. And then behind Wright and Wheaton, you've got just a plethora of no-names. You've got Josh Bellamy, who, by the way, I'm still surprised the Bears ended up keeping him. I know in our last podcast, we previewed who the Bears would cut at wide receiver. We were right with Victor Cruz, but personally, I was surprised that Josh Bellamy stayed. You've got Deontay Thompson, who is great at special teams, but not so great at receiving. And then you've also got Kevin White. Oh, wait a minute. No, you don't. Because he's been out, ruled out at least, for the entire year now with yet another injury. So when you really take a look at the Bears wide receiving situation, in my opinion, it doesn't matter who is the quarterback, whether it's Glennon, whether it's Aaron Rodgers even, because in the end, you need wide receivers to do their jobs in order for you being the quarterback, to do well. I mean, let's look back at the Packers game. 2 of the interceptions that Glennon threw were technically not his fault. One of them, the receiver didn't run the right route, so Glennon overthrew him and it was intercepted. And in another instance, the receiver slipped and the ball was just intercepted. How is that Glennon's fault? Now, the fumbles, that's pretty much inexcusable. Those are Glennon's mistakes, whether it's miscommunication at the line or whether it's Glennon not getting out of the way of pressure. But as far as interceptions goes, not all of those have necessarily been his fault. And the question is, let's say Trubisky was in the game during these times. What do you think he would be doing right now? You think all of a sudden, just because it's a different name, it's a rookie, it's a number 2 overall pick, he's not going to have eerily similar stats to Glennon? If you have the wide receiving core that the Bears have right now, there is no way that you will do well, and again, you being a quarterback. Looking at other parts of Glennon and his statistics, though, he hasn't really been doing that horribly. I mean, his completion percentage is at 66.4%, and he's averaging over 200 yards per game. I mean, that's what you want to see from your quarterback, right? It's just that due to the lack of his supporting cast, it's looking as if Glennon is performing horribly. But if you take a deeper look into his statistics, he's not doing bad to the point to where Mitchell Trubisky needs to come in right away. And I was talking to somebody a couple days ago about this, and I said, look, if Glennon was on the Chiefs, let's say, where Alex Smith is, I think Glennon will be performing quite similar to Alex Smith. Both guys are actually similar themselves. They're both game managers. They don't throw the ball deep downfield. They're not gunslingers who can throw the ball 60 or 70 yards and get a touchdown all the time, but they're guys who can manage the game, who can give you a very good completion percentage, and who can score, what, 15 or 16 touchdowns per season and maybe 10 interceptions. There's nothing wrong with that. And looking at Alex Smith, at least he has offensive weapons. I mean, his WR1 is Tyreek Hill. He has 16 catches for 253 yards this season. And then you've got Kareem Hunt, the upstart rookie, who leads the league in rushing yards and also has 137 receiving yards of his own. So he's a guy who can both run and catch, maybe similar to a Matt Forte. When you have guys like that on your offense, guys who can catch balls, who won't drop balls inside the red zone, who won't blow games because of that, then you can be successful. For the Bears, they don't have any offensive weapons. Sure, they have Jordan Howard, but he has proven to us this year and part of last year that he cannot catch the ball as a running back. And it's apparent. He dropped a ball inside the 5-yard line. The Bears could have beaten the Falcons if he didn't drop it. So before we all go out and say Mitchell Trubisky needs to come in right away, give Mike Lennon some credit. He has put up with some horrible offensive play and has persevered. I'd like to see how he does continually down the season, but I'll tell you this much. If the Bears are out of it by week 10 or week 11 and Glennon continues to perform like this, which isn't horrible but isn't amazing, then yes, I can see Trubisky coming in. But don't give up on Glennon just yet. You shouldn't be able to penalize him just because he doesn't have any weapons. That's not right, because I'll tell you one thing. Everyone will realize that it's not the QB, it's the team itself. And finally, let's move on now to the Chicago Blackhawks. Right now, in preseason mode, their regular season starting in the middle of October, they faced the Detroit Red Wings, though, in a recent preseason game, and they did win 4-2, with Anton Forsberg starting at the goalie position. In the first period, Forsberg was perfect, and he finished with 33 saves total. He ended up giving 2 goals up in the end, but this guy is now going to be the likely backup for the Hawks. So they did lose Scott Darling to free agency, which was a shame because, number one, he was a hometown guy, and number two, he did really well in that backup's role. But it looks like Forsberg has solidified his presence and hopefully will perform just as well, if not better, than Darling. Also, look out for Alex DeBrincat. He scored the go-ahead goal in the third period. He's trying to push for a roster spot. DeBrincat is a former OHL and CHL Player of the Year. The Hawks actually got him, and they picked him in the draft after they traded Andrew Shaw to the Canadiens. This is a guy who's also on the ESPN Top 100 NHL Prospects list at number 50. So DeBrincat is a top prospect, a guy who is either going to make the team or get sent down to Rockford, but he is making his case right now in the preseason, so look out for him as we get near the beginning of the NHL regular season. And by the way, it is coming up, the Hawks' first game this year on October 5th, as they face the Pittsburgh Penguins, reigning Stanley Cup champions at Pittsburgh. Can't wait for the Hawks this year. Should be another productive season. And with reinforcements like DeBrincat and Forsberg, the Hawks should be ready for another deep run in the playoffs. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his broadcasting career in 1982 as the TV and radio voice of the Kansas City Kings. By 1991, he was also calling NFL football on NBC and Minnesota Timberwolves basketball games. Today, he broadcasts national football games on CBS and Westwood One, as well as basketball on TNT, and he is also the voice of the NBA 2K video game series. Please welcome Kevin Harlan to the show. Kevin, how you doing today? Thank you for being here on the show.
John, great. Thanks again for asking me. I always enjoy visiting with you, and it's good to be on again with you.
So, first off, I'd like to talk about the NBA and all these roster moves that have been happening over the past few months. I mean, Paul George and Carmelo Anthony on the Thunder, you know, Kyrie going to Boston, Derrick Rose and Dwayne Wade on Cleveland. So, what are your thoughts on the increased presence of super teams, and what do you think they mean for the NBA?
I think players are realizing that they've got to be with other great players to beat championship caliber. You can't carry a team by yourself. LeBron has tried, and there just wasn't enough star power in Cleveland. And And so he went to Miami. And now he's back in Cleveland and had Kyrie for a while. And they got Kevin Love. And certainly they made a nice run in, actually won a championship. But I think these players realize if you don't have a guy that is equal to your best player and have multiple of them, you're going to be in trouble. And that's just the way the league is set up right now. The teams, the players are all within the guidelines of the way the rules are set up. So it's conducive to getting, you know, these super teams, as you say, together. It makes it very interesting. There's a lot of intrigue with them. At the same time, there are a lot of teams that are lagging and aren't even close to that. And you know exactly before the season even begins, you know, where they're going to finish up, that there's no way they can compete against some of the teams we've seen compiled in Houston and Oklahoma City and certainly in Golden State and now Boston. So it's a tough go, but it does make it very interesting in the off season to see these different moves, these players change teams, try to put together, you know, some kind of the fabric of a championship club with some off season maneuvering. I find that process fascinating.
And yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, thinking about it from years ago, you would never see Derrick Rose being in a Cleveland uniform, you know, a former NBA MVP with the Bulls, now with Cleveland. So yeah, it's very interesting. So you mentioned the NBA Finals. So who do you see winning the NBA Finals this year now with all these different super teams existing here in the NBA?
Well, I think we're going to have to wait until we see what kind of injury situation a lot of these teams have to go through. And as we've seen too, you know, you can go through the regular season and be good and then drive it up a notch and be great in the postseason. You can conserve. You can, you know, parcel minutes. You can build your bench without having to play your top-tier players. And the exhaustive nature of the season, the way it's set up, although this year will be easier since they're starting earlier and fewer back-to-back games, but the exhaustive nature, the way the league is set up and the schedule, you know, makes it that, you know, to get through the regular season, you need that bench. And there's going to be a time in the postseason when that bench is going to come into play and is going to win a game for you, certainly make a dent. And I think that it's incumbent on these teams to be good, but perhaps not, you know, aim for being great. Now, after the All-Star game, you can see teams ratcheted up because you want to get the kind of pace in the postseason you want in the last couple, 3 weeks of the regular season. And so after the All-Star break, you usually find the play really tightens and gets good, and the pace is better, and teams, as opposed to just trying to survive in the first three quarters of the year, make that last quarter of the year really count as a nice run up to the postseason.
So we were talking about the finals. You know, the Bulls are far from them, let's be honest. You know, many are predicting the team to finish dead last in the Eastern Conference this year, which is due to a number of factors. I mean, Wade and Butler leaving, the team itself. So how do you feel about the Bulls this season? I mean, although bright spots are few and far between, is there anything interesting to keep an eye on when talking about them?
Well, I think Levine's an interesting player, certainly, and I've always thought his athleticism was just like among the elite in the NBA as it was in college at UCLA. I like him. I know Minnesota didn't want to get rid of him. But when you lose guys like Wade and Butler, those are two pretty powerhouse players to lose in one off season. And now they're both gone. And so I really don't know what to make of the Bulls. It's one of my favorite stops in the league, and I'm not sure we're going to get there this year. It looks like a season of rebuilding. To be quite honest, the best move they've made, I think, is hiring Doug Collins as a consultant. I think they're in need of some real depth and some real know-how. A guy who's played, coached, and broadcasted. He knows the game inside and out. He's as clever as they come, and I think he'll be a terrific addition to their front office.
So I wanted to shift gears now, go to the NFL. I would like to get your take on a topic that has involved both players and politicians alike. So, you know, more and more players are either kneeling or interlocking arms during the national anthem. Now, you're a very prominent sportscaster with the NFL, as I mentioned, CBS, Westwood One. What do you think about this behavior? You know, is it good for the sport? Any thoughts on the behavior being exhibited here by these NFL players?
Well, you know, like every American, they've got the right to express their views. Whether it's proper during the national anthem is a probably another subject and one I'm probably not prepared to talk about. But I think the day that we don't let people have a voice in, you know, what they feel in this country where freedom is a right, you know, that becomes an issue. And I can see why there are people upset. And I think that, you know, what a lot of these players are protesting with their kneeling or sitting or whatever they're doing is trying to make a point out of what they feel are injustices within their community and, within their race. So I'm all for free speech. Like I said, I'm not certain that the anthem is the best way to carry it out, but it seems to be one of the few public ways these players can operate, and let their feelings be known in a very public way. It's uncomfortable to watch, I think, for every American, probably very uncomfortable for those players to do, but it's something that they feel strongly about. And, the day that we begin to, you know, snuff out voices and thought and conversation is a day where our country fails to be what our country was based on. So, I am pro-American and I am pro-national anthem, but at the same time, I recognize the right for people to demonstrate the way they feel they need to demonstrate.
Definitely. And in their Thursday night game, the Bears actually interlocked arms during the anthem. Yet, following their protest, the game went horribly. They are now 1-3 on the year. Many are calling for the benching of Mike Glennon. So, two questions for you. First, why are the Bears performing at such a lowly level? And also, what are your thoughts on the QB situation? Is it time to give Trubisky a chance?
I think I'd wait for Trubisky until we get into the month of October, maybe even the end, get halfway through this season. And if it continues the way it is, I think you probably proceed by seeing what this very highly drafted quarterback can do. There's obviously stuff you liked about him. We're seeing other rookie quarterbacks recently star. Dak Prescott in Dallas last year, a good early sign from Deshaun Watson down in Houston already. So we're seeing young quarterbacks and very smart coaching staffs and play callers, you know, position these quarterbacks, although with little experience, in a way where they can succeed and perform. So I'm anxious to see how John Fox, a veteran coach who's been to, you know, Super Bowls, how he handles this. And I think we'll have an answer here pretty soon. I'm not sure where the Bears season is going. The win over Pittsburgh certainly was unexpected and welcome, but they didn't look all that good against Green Bay. So there's just a lot that needs to be siphoned out. Plus, they got, you know, I don't know. I've not seen the Bears in person. I've seen them in a couple weeks in Chicago on Monday night, but how Trubisky has, you know, developed with, you know, that offense. How is he growing? And I think those are all questions that need to be answered, but only the coach can. And so we'll get the answer, but I think in very short order.
Now, before we end today, I'd like to talk about your broadcasting career, specifically about your involvement with 2K Sports. So obviously your extensive track record made you worthy of receiving the job, but what's the story behind it? So how did you become the voice of an extremely successful video game franchise?
Well, it just kind of came my way unexpectedly many years ago when the league put me in a position to do these games, and it was, you know, the world of video games when I started in 2005 does not have, you know, near the great mechanics and genius that goes into them now. They were pretty, you know, barren. There was not a lot to them, and they've just grown exponentially as the internet and as computing and everything else has developed with smartphones and everything else. And so doing the game has become more complex for people like me and all the people we bring onto it. But growing with the game has been incredibly satisfying. I'm just amazed at what these very smart guys can do. And how they engineer the game, where they come up with the ideas, how they're constantly on the edge of creativity, limited only by the size of their imagination. It's an amazing process to be a part of, I'm honored to be a part of it. The NBA is totally in back of it. This is the game that they say is their official game. It outsells Madden, and I think it's second only in the world to FIFA. So they've made great strides, and they continue to get better and more refined and more advanced with every edition.
And finally, on a humorous note, I wanted to ask you about your play-by-play call of a fan being tackled by security on Monday Night Football. Why did you decide to do it? And I have to say, personally, I cracked up the first time I heard it.
Well, thank you, John. It was it was truly off the cuff. You never prepare for anything like that, and as it turned out, everybody was okay with it. I was, to be quite honest, at the time after I'd done it, kind of skeptical and felt like perhaps I shouldn't have done that. The league does not like us talking about people that run out on the field. I am hired by the league in a way when they okay the announcers, and so it becomes kind of a treasured position to have, and you never want to put it in peril. And I thought maybe I had by talking about the guy that ran out there, but the league liked it. My bosses at Westwood One and CBS were fine with it. And as long as everyone was okay with it, that's great. I doubt I'll do it again, but for that one moment in a boring game, late in the game, with very little going on, this kid had free reign of the field for over a minute. And that to me was kind of humorous. And he almost looked like a player running around in circles because no security was out there to tackle. So it was fun, and I'm glad it was well received, but I doubt I'll do it again.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. Such an honor to have you on. Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, and call me again. We're in the middle of football and the beginning of basketball. It's a busy time for us, so having lengthy conversations sometimes is difficult, but I do enjoy being on with you and continue to watch you grow in the business, and I hope you'll call me again sometime.
Thank you so much, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
Take care, John. Thanks again.
What an honor it was to have Kevin Harlan here on the show. What a great guy, one of my personal favorite broadcasters, and really nice of him to take some time and talk about some NBA and NFL news and notes. So it's now time for our closing segments. We'll start with the odd sports story of the day. This is from June 17th, 1953. The Boston Red Sox were facing the Detroit Tigers. Here's part of the article from InsiderMonkey.com. The Red Sox shamelessly defeat the Tigers by a painful 17-1 final. The very next day, the Tigers lose the rematch when the Red Sox once again manage to score 17 runs. What's most spectacular is that all the runs were scored in one inning, the most ever in any American League baseball game. So that is your odd sports story of the day. We're going to move on now to the punchline of the day segment. So here's the question. Which insect didn't play well at quarterback? The answer, the fumblebee. That was your punchline of the day segment. And finally, it's our famed announcer's call of the day segment, my personal favorite, and a lot of viewers have expressed those same views. So we're going to have a great clip for you folks, and one that also has to do with Kevin Harlan, who is just on the show. So if you caught my final question, I asked him about his call on Monday Night Football, where he called a fan being tackled by security. He expressed laughter. He thought it was very funny. He said he wouldn't do it again. But in his honor, we're going to play that clip for you right here on Sports Talk Chicago. Let's take a listen.
Four looks into the nickel of San Francisco in the secondary. Hey, somebody has run out on the field. Some goofball in a hat and a red shirt. Now he takes off the shirt. He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. Now he runs the opposite way. He runs to the 50. He runs to the 40. The guy is drunk, but there he goes. The 20. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him. Waving his arms, bare-chested. Somebody stop
that
man.
Look out. Here comes the blue coat, Kevin.
Oh, they got him.
Here comes
they're coming
the blue
from
coat.
The left. Oh, and they tackle him at the 40-yard line.
Oh, that was the most exciting thing to happen tonight. I tell you what, that was a great call on your part.
An awesome call by Kevin Harlan. Great to have him here on the show once again. I just want to thank him. And very funny there on that last call. Well, that's it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Make sure to check us out at Chi Talk Sports on Twitter. Also, hit me up personally on Instagram, Google Plus, and LinkedIn, all at John Zacks. Again, I want to thank you all for listening to this show. Thank you again to Kevin Harlan, and have a great day.